Hello, once again, and welcome back to the Box Bop WAMC's live call-in talk show. Joining us on this Medical Monday to discuss mental health and substance abuse issues is Dr. Jennifer Michaels. Boy, do we love her. Medical Director of the Breen Center, Berkshire County's largest community mental health agency. Dr. Michaels is also Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Massachusetts. She's board certified in both general and addiction psychiatry, has been in practice for over 15 years, and is an outstanding member of the Berkshire Medical Center. And we love the Berkshire Medical Center and its president, David Phelps. Dr. Michaels, welcome back to Medical Monday.
Thank you. It's good to be back, Alan.
The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. Every phone is going to be busy in a minute. 1-800-348-2551. Don't be yelling at me after the show that you didn't get in. Do it now. You can also post comments at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website, wamc.org/VoxPop. You can comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. You can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop, and you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. So, Dr. Michaels, while the phones aren't ringing, I'll ask you the first question. I love it when this happens. What's hot? What are you pushing?
What are we pushing? Well, I'm personally not pushing anything, but...
Isn't there a yellow piece of paper in front of you?
Oh, I am. Yes, I will push that. It's a movie that's free. It's this Thursday at the Beacon Cinema, and it starts at 6:45. It's called The Anonymous People. The Anonymous People. And it's a wonderful documentary about people who are sober in recovery. And I think it will help to destigmatize and educate people about addiction and recovery.
And what's more with that info? When is it?
Oh, okay. Thursday, December 19th, 6:45 to 9 o'clock at the Beacon Cinema in Pittsfield. The movie is The Anonymous People, and there are stars, there are regular Joes, there are teachers, lawyers, you know, you name it, talking about their addiction and recovery.
Is this a tough time right now in this period before, you know, between Hanukkah and Christmas and everything else? Is this a tough time for people with addiction problems?
I think it's a huge time for them, because what happens is they say, well, I'll get help in January. And so they kind of...
I do that with my diet.
You know, most of us do that. You know, January 1st, I'll stop eating cookies, or if I'm an addict, I'll stop using heroin, or I'll stop drinking a bottle or two of wine every night. And so this can be a very tough month. Also, we see our families, and many families use together. And so I have patients who will say, well, if I go to Christmas, I'm going to smoke pot, or I'm going to drink, because that's what we all do together.
Wow.
Yeah. And so being sober for the holidays means not seeing the family sometimes.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And you have to tell your clients maybe it would be better not to see the family?
I don't like to say that. I try to help them to think creatively.
Yeah.
You know, to have a prevention plan, and how do you get out
you
early?
You walk in the crowd, you say, you know, you got me into this.
It's all your fault. We try to stage family interventions over the turkey at Thanksgiving.
Let's go to David in Johnstown, 1-800-348-2551. There you go. David, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I hate to start the program with a negative comment, but a lot of people think that... The biggest drug dealers in the country are doctors.
Mm.
And, well, they do, you know, like oxycodone or something like that.
Oxycontin.
Okay.
Well, I don't know what it is. It's sort of like a synthetic heroin, I guess. I don't know. But, and then they'll pinpoint these people that go mad, you know, and they start shooting people up, and they say, well... they were on some sort of prescription drugs. You know, it's a dangerous thing, isn't it?
Okay, David, we got the point.
That's it. Thank you very much.
No, stay right there.
David, I think you hit the nail on the head in some ways.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay, so our population in the United States comprises 5% of the world's population. What percent of the world's opioids do we consume?
This is a, this is a guess question?
This is a quiz for you, Alan. So we're 5% of the world's population. What percentage of the world's opioid supply do we consume?
I'm going to guess 72%.
Oh, you're so close. 80%.
No!
80%.
I took the most ridiculous figure I could figure.
It's even more ridiculous.
Yeah. 80%. That's
so
amazing.
So we, you know, what he said is very true. We do have a serious problem. We have a pill nation. We consume 80% of the world's opioid supply, 66% of the world's illegal drugs, and we want to be medicated. And if you open a magazine, you will see these advertisements for you name it.
Well, I just recently had a successful back operation, I'm pleased to say.
Good.
And they gave me some of those very pills we're talking about right now. I never touched one of them because I don't believe in that in that stuff. But this stuff is, there's a lot of it out there.
There's a lot of it out there. And, you know, I don't want to minimize that some people really need this medicine and we want them to have it. We don't want people to suffer unnecessarily. But we are guilty of over-prescribing, over-seeking pills in this society.
Now, are these opioids very dangerous?
They're dangerous. In this country, you're more likely to die from an opioid overdose than a car accident.
Are you more likely to die from an opioid? I'm probably going to mess myself up. Than a heroin overdose, or are they the same sort of?
Well, heroin is a type of opioid,
right?
And it's shifting. So you know, it's so complicated.
I'm talking about a prescribed opioid versus an illegal opioid.
Either one can kill you.
Yes.
What we're finding is as we get better at curtailing access to opioid pills, you know, we are diminishing diversion of pills. Fewer people are overdosing on pills, and more people are overdosing on heroin. So it's moving from, he's adjusting my sound.
I'm adjusting your microphone because I'm told by a caller who's watching us on WAMC.org that they can't see your face. So I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing. This way, a little this way? Okay, I'll do it this way.
Okay.
Okay, here we go. Okay. How's that? Yeah, good, says Zachary.
Okay, okay good. Great. Very good. So as we curtail access to opioid pills, we are seeing more people overdosing on heroin. So the epidemic of opioid abuse, it was
interesting.
It really started with pills, but of concern is we're now moving into a heroin phase.
That's so interesting that, you know, it's like Al Capp used to write about the schmooze, and if you stepped on one side, you know, the other side would come up. Mm-hmm. And that is so interesting that that we create, on the one hand, the opioids are legal until they're illegal, the prescribed opioids. So then there's people, they're out there, people start to sell them. But the heroin, that's an illegal market, and obviously that is run by the mob. Or a mob of one kind or another.
Sure. And heroin is extremely potent and very cheap. What I say to my patients is it's cheaper to get a bag of heroin than my favorite hot fudge sundae at the ice cream store. You can get a bag of heroin in some places for $5.
But once you're in...
Oh, you're in, and it multiplies.
Yeah.
And it's very scary.
That's great. Let's go to Frank in Greenville. All right, Frank.
Yes, ma'am. Good morning. Oh, good afternoon. My question is, and I'll just have to hang up and listen, what was or is LSD, and did it or does it have a legitimate use to it?
Okay, no, don't hang up, Frank. Go ahead.
Sure.
Well, I have to.
Oh, okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
You must. Okay.
All right.
Thank you, Frank. LSD is a hallucinogen, and it was created as a chemical and has been used for decades.
Now that's all right.
Yeah. We're having a raucous time here, aren't we?
We are. It's all my fault, I admit it.
It is. Thank you. Anyway, it is an LSD. It is a hallucinogen that leads to psychedelic experience, distortions, what we call synesthesias. Synesthesias mean that you hear colors or you see sounds. It's a distortion of your sensorium. And they have no clinical value. They're drugs of abuse.
Timothy Leary aside.
Yes. Well, Timothy, if he were alive, would differ from my opinion, but yes.
I thought they were insight. You could get insights that you wouldn't get unless you were under them. Yes. But I'm with you. let there be no mistake about that.
And you know, I tend to see the worst outcome. So what I So I see people who have post-hallucinogen perceptual disorder, meaning that they're no longer using the hallucinogen, but they're left with visual hallucinations or uncomfortable body spasms that are related to their LSD use. So I don't get, I didn't see the expansion of the world. I see the consequences of abuse.
And we will go to, we will go nowhere. We'll be right back. And Fred and Jonathan, you stay right there. 1-800-348-2551.
Support comes from Premier Medical Group, gastroenterology, urology, internal medicine, endocrinology, geriatrics, nephrology, and pulmonology, with offices throughout the Hudson Valley. PremierMedicalHV.com. Curran Compliance Services, LLC, Greenwich, New York. Legal and consulting services on regulatory issues for life insurance and annuity manufacturers and distributors. CurranCompliance.com. Anderson Center for Autism, Statsburg, New York. Working to improve lives on the spectrum from 18 months to adulthood. Diagnosis to graduation, AndersonCares.org. And Bow Wow Bathhouse Resort and Daycare, South Deerfield, Massachusetts. For over 7 years, providing 10 hours of daily indoor-outdoor play, professional grooming, and retail shop. TheBowWowBathhouse.com.
And we are back, thanks to Zachary. Okay, let's go to Fred in Ulster County. Fred, you're on.
Hi, thanks, Alan. Thank you. I have a friend, a woman, early 60s, heart meds. Everyone would say alcohol issues, who has these incredible mood swings, refuses to get any kind of treatment, and... can go from, you know, but she almost schizophrenic, seemingly. Pardon me. And she'll go from this little girly girl voice, and she's always mocking and being really nasty about people. All of a sudden, she'll change her mood, and she's also kind of very isolated in her world. She's an artist, and I'm just wondering, you know, what can be done. You know, other than the fact that there are a couple of us who are doing our damnedest to, excuse my English, keep an eye on her, you know, and keep her as straight as possible. You know, she really is a lovely person down when it comes down to it. But how can we proceed?
Fred, it's a little confusing. Is she using substances all the time?
Alcohol, yes.
Okay. So this is a very common problem. I get phone calls like this all the time. You know, I love my son, but he's using, he won't stop. What do I do about it? And it's very hard to make people stop, if not impossible, unless they're at least a little motivated. So, one thing to do is to gather the troops and consider something like an intervention.
We've done that, and she, you know, she fights it, and I don't know how to, you know, get beyond that. You know, I mean, is there any way to get beyond that?
So you actually have...
Without having, you know, her do something atrocious that, you know, puts her life and her life's works in jeopardy kind of thing.
So I don't know if you employed a professional interventionist who would organize the event and create the script to help it be successful. That's one suggestion that
maybe... Where do you find such a person?
You can call Hazelden. You can call Betty Ford, and they have people who are more local who can help. We have someone at the Breen Center, Bob Cote, who I think is fantastic. That's another option. But this is what they do. They're professional interventionists. So sometimes people try to do this on their own, and it doesn't work because there's a certain style, a way of focusing on the person's problem in a very loving, supportive way. So that would be my suggestion for her. And the other thing is for all of you to consider Al-Anon. And Al-Anon is a wonderful program for the people who love someone who has a substance problem. And you may pick up some ways to help that person at an Al-Anon meeting. You can go online, Google Al-Anon, and you'll find meetings in your area.
Okay, thank you so much.
Fred, thank you for calling.
Right. Bye-bye.
Let's go to Jonathan of South Egremont. Hey, Jonathan, how you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good.
I had seen today on the internet a reference to a summit that was held at the White House, and Harvard's John Kelly, director of the new Recovery Research Institute at Mass General, talked about changing the language of substance abuse. The problem being the word abuse carries some degree of blame. And he suggests that we use the word misuse. And he even has done a study which has shown that even highly trained clinicians are influenced by that language. Let me just get to... are you familiar with what I'm talking about?
Yes, and there has been a lot of work done in this area because the very terms we use to describe people who have a what we'll call a use disorder, the very terms are stigmatizing. So
right.
If I say someone is an addict, an alcoholic, they're dependent, it connotes a negative feeling about that person. The current terminology used by psychiatrists is a substance use disorder.
Okay, because even in the promos they talked to, with you today on the radio, they called it substance abuse.
Well, we will work.
She can't be responsible for what I do.
It's really
no. But I'm just saying
that was Alan's
fault. Let's educate everybody out there that the terms abuse is old school. And let's use the appropriate use.
As long as I'm in it, Jonathan, let me just say...
I don't have it.
No, I know that. But it is true that in AA, obviously, people stand up and say, I'm an alcoholic. Yeah. Because they're recognizing a fact of life, that they are. You could change the name, but... The recognition, the self-recognition, I suspect, is very important.
No, it has nothing to do with that recognition. I think that's wonderful, and I don't have a problem with identifying people, but by using the term abuse, let me just read you. Those clinicians exposed to the substance abuse term were significantly more likely to judge the person as more to blame and more deserving of punishment than the exact same individual described as having a substance use disorder. And these are highly trained clinicians.
Interesting. Dr. Michaels?
Well, I think we're kind of in a fix because we want people to self-identify the problem they have. And yet society has stigmatized those very terms. So,
But misuse is not stigma. There's, at least at present, misuse is way less stigmatizing than abuse. Abuse carries a lot of judgment. Misuse, much less judgment,
so,
in my opinion.
Okay, so in DSM-5, which is the most recent formulation for psychiatric diagnosing, we call people who have this disorder people struggling with a substance use disorder.
I understand. That's what I'm arguing for, is let's use the term use and get rid of the term abuse.
Well, you can call me Ishmael or you can call me a cynic, but I got to tell you, how long will it be after you say misuse that somebody arrives with the theory that this has got a negative connotation also?
And then we'll get the next better word. But yeah. For now, it's way better.
Okay, gotcha, Jonathan. Thanks for the call. Appreciate
it.
Yeah, bye. Let's go to David in Livingston. Okay, David in Livingston Manor, you're on.
Hi, this is David. Can you hear me?
We can.
Yes.
I'm a chef by trade, and I have studied the history of drugs and pharmaceuticals, and I just wanted to make a comment. All of your discussion is most refreshing, I can tell you that. The thing that bothers me about our culture is that people think that they can live a life and consume a diet, whatever they want, and when they become ill, all they have to do is take a pill and they'll be fine. This is a paradigm that really has to change. And that's a change dramatically. I think that the pharmaceutical industry has kind of taken all of us hostage, and you know, with this paradigm that you can just take a pill and you'll be fine. It's more complex than that, and pharmaceuticals are not the answer. They're all toxic, and they're all dangerous. This has been proven from aspirin to ibuprofen to the COX-3 inhibitors. So I just wanted to make a comment about that. People really need to reexamine how they view their own health and their health care maintenance.
Thank you. And Alan and I were just discussing the front page of the Sunday Times. I don't know if you had a chance to look at it, but treatment for ADHD has gone from 5% of children to 15%.
It's huge.
The article talked about just that, the promotion of stimulants to treat attentional issues.
So we're talking about Ritalin, things like that.
Ritalin, yes.
I bring to your attention Dr. Thomas Armstrong's book on that very subject called The Myth of ADHD. In other words, the pharmaceutical industry, his premise is that the pharmaceutical industry has created this ailment in order to sell their drug.
Well,
and it's not an effective remedy.
No, it's complicated because any one of us can focus better with a little stimulant. I mean, I know that when I drink my cup of coffee in the morning.
Right.
And now stimulants are being abused by college students or people taking exams. And there's an incentive to get that diagnosis because you get longer time to take your test.
Right.
But it also dilutes the treatment for people who really need it. And that's about 5% of children.
Yeah. So David, my comment would be, and I appreciate your call very much because I think there's a lot of truth in it, but my comment would be, the moment you say all or every, I think that you create an idea that there's nothing good coming out of this stuff at all. Because I think, sometimes there are. You talk to anybody who had a schizophrenic in their family, a person with schizophrenia, 30 years ago, and what the differences are 40 years ago, what the differences are now, it's extraordinary.
Yeah.
Because
you make I agree with you. You make a very valid point. But I'll close with a comment from Hippocrates, who said, "Let food be your medicine, and let medicine be your food."
And you're the chef. Thank you. Thanks, David.
Thank you.
Yeah, bye.
Bye-bye.
And we'll go to Sean in Lloyd. Okay, Sean, you're on.
Hey, I just caught the piece about LSD, and I just wanted to weigh in a little bit about a dimension of it that I think is often overlooked. And that is that historically, and I, of course, wanted your feedback and your thoughts, historically, consciousness altering as somehow a little distinct, you could probably describe better from alcohol, something that really changes your senses, the way you think, like LSD. I think in most cultures, I could be wrong about most, but many, there is in a paradigm of the sacred. And you know, you can't solve a problem with the same thing that created it type of thing. I wondered, I don't know, your thoughts of how you see that. I know LSD is synthetic, but mushrooms or, is there any component of this that relates to, if guided, if mentored, et cetera, it's different than just some kids going, hey, let's, quote unquote, trip out.
Well, Sean, let me ask you a question, and I hope you understand it's respectful and insightful on your part. Have you tried LSD?
Yes.
Okay. Now, Dr. Michaels.
Okay. Well, there are certain cultures, certain religions that have substance use embedded in a very meaningful way in the culture, and that could be alcohol, it could be ayahuasca, or psilocybin, and that's very different than using a drug to get high. And people who have those religious experiences, and again, it's part of their religion, the use of these substances in small quantities, are able to use it effectively without some of the consequences that we see with substance use disorders. So I don't know if that answers your question, Sean, but that's different. That's kind of like looking at someone who maybe someone who drinks at the Kaddish, they have some wine, versus someone at a bar having, you know,
six
three
bourbons,
pints.
Yeah,
that's very different.
Right.
So something that's embedded in your culture and supported by people in your group, it's very different, and the outcome is very different.
Sean, I'm so sorry. We've got five people behind you. I'm going to let you go. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thanks again. And let's go to Gerard in Woodstock. Gerard, you're on.
Hello. Yes. The first fellow that came on mentioned about the largest drug dealers being doctors with prescriptions. I was just wondering whether wouldn't alcohol be, you know, one of the and liquor stores being the largest drug dealers? I mean, and it's legal.
Yes, and it's the most abused substance in our country.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's a very insightful call. Thank you, Gerard. Appreciate it.
You got it.
Yep.
Goodbye.
Let's go to Tina in Dutchess County. Tina.
Hi.
How you doing?
So I'm good. This is the first time I've ever got through to you folks. So I'm calling about the psychedelic issue as well. My father was an anthropologist, and I've studied extensively world religions and their history, and all prehistoric peoples took psychedelic substances, whether it was ayahuasca, psilocybin, Amanita muscaria mushrooms, peyote, all kinds of substances all over the planet. And that's what gave rise to religions. They're considered entheogens in that they allowed the human being to engender and embody God. And they were considered sacred. Now, when acid, LSD, was first synthesized by Bernard Aronson and Humphrey Osmond up at Harvard, they found it by accident. And then they were actually using it to help psychoactive patients, just people with psychological disorders. And the government got a hold of it, and the Army got a hold of it, and they tried to find a way to use it militarily. And when they couldn't, they decided that it was a threat to society. They pushed it underground. They made it illegal. And now the drugs that people are left with to ingest legally do not lead to anything sacred.
Okay, we're going to stop you right there, and we're going to ask the doctor for her response. Go ahead.
Well, I agree that those drugs have been, as I said before, embedded in certain religions. I don't know that those drugs are responsible for religion. I don't know that I can agree with your statement. But it's when we start to take any substance and use it just to get high that we run into trouble.
So, well, I agree with that, and I think that the motivation behind anyone's ingesting anything is of the paramount importance and the primary factor. And if you look at the individual psychological or personality condition of the person, you can pretty well get a handle on what it is they're going to ingest. But psychedelics are not addictive substances. It's impossible to become addicted to them.
Okay,
Hold on a second, Tina. Go ahead.
I would have to disagree with that because I have treated many people who couldn't stay stopped from their psychedelic use. And, I think there's danger in saying that they're non-addictive because I sadly worked with people who had used so much that they weren't able to see clearly because when they would have flashbacks to when they were high and they would see dollar signs or they would see the pyramids on dollars and they couldn't drive and they couldn't read, they were so damaged. So and they also developed tolerance, meaning that they needed more and more of the same drug to get the same effect. So I disagree with that, and I think that they can be dangerous for certain people, they can be addictive, and they can be associated with very bad depressions and even suicide when people withdraw.
And Tina, before you go on, Jennifer, my question to you is, this business about the difference between addictive, and we hear about sleeping pills all the time that aren't addictive, but people get addicted to them because they can't sleep without taking a pill, although the manufacturers say these aren't addictive pills. Could you deal with that for a second?
So the word addictive is out there, and I think we all can relate to what it means, although it's kind of vague. It means taking something in a compulsive, excessive way.
Like Diet Pepsi.
Yes. Yes, like Diet Pepsi or, you know, red velvet cake.
Yeah, sure.
You know, in a I could say cupcakes. Routinely I'm addicted to red velvet cupcakes, but that doesn't mean the same as I'm addicted to alcohol and seriously
yeah, yeah.
mean that.
Because that has an addictive component to it. Is that what it is?
It changes your brain.
Yeah, interesting.
It really changes your brain. So if you engage in chronic substance use, you alter your brain so that your brain will promote ongoing use of that substance and you'll experience withdrawal.
Hey, Tina, I'm so sorry, but we are running out of time. I appreciate your call. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Middletown Medical, now offering evening walk-in urgent care for children every weeknight until 9, plus evening sports physicals. MiddletownMedical.com. The Alternative Baker, Rosendale. Small batch, all butter, handmade baked goods with allergy-friendly options. Taking orders for Christmas and New Year's, LemonCakes.com. And HMT at the Spa Little Theater, presenting Roald Dahl's Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, weekends through December 22nd, Saratoga Spa State Park, homemadetheater.org.
And here we are, back again with Dr. Jennifer Michaels. She is a brilliant psychiatrist and medical director of the Breen Center, Berkshire County's largest community mental health agency, and also assistant professor of psychiatry at the University of Massachusetts. And, of course, she works at the Berkshire Medical Center, and which is a great friend of WAMC. So let's go to Mary in Niski. Mary, you're on.
Hi, Dr. Michael.
Hello.
I realize what you just said about addiction, that it is connected to a change in the brain. When I called, my question was specifically about the term food addiction. You know, I've seen books about it. I've read about it. I'm a middle-aged woman who has fought weight problems my entire life. And I'm wondering if you could speak to that as a potential actual addiction or if it's something other than that. And, you know, what's your thoughts on food addiction?
Okay. You know, we think about drugs when we think about addiction, but we know that people can get addicted to food. We know that, and there actually are brain scans that have been done examining dopamine levels in different parts of the brain, and mm-hmm. someone who is truly food addicted will have a brain scan that looks like someone who is addicted to alcohol. And what is similar is low functioning dopamine. Dopamine is our neurotransmitter that makes us feel good, that gives us reward. And if you're truly addicted, you will have this hypofunctional or low functioning dopamine system in your brain. And so it does really exist. And now there's some science looking at the types of food that are more addicting. And those are things like simple carbohydrates.
Right.
And so, you know, if you're thinking about what to eat, you want to think about a rainbow of colors. And I always say it's very bad to be prejudiced, except with your food. And with your food, avoid white. Like mm-hmm. rice, pasta, breads mm-hmm. are all foods that lend themselves to addictive behaviors.
In yeah. other words, they become triggers.
Yes. And yes. And they very quickly increase your blood sugar and then insulin goes up and it creates this cascade that is addictive in quality will cause your body and brain to operate in a way very different than healthy foods.
Is the same thing true about sex and dopamine?
Dopamine is released when you have sex. Yes.
Interesting. Yeah. Mary, great call. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye now.
Bye. Let's go to Ted in Gilderland. Ted, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon, Alan. Good afternoon, Doctor. I have a question. In the last 6 years, starting at about Memorial Day, going into maybe the third week in June, I get this rush of mania. I'm diagnosed bipolar mania. And, you know, I become a person who multitasks to be a person who is just focused on one item. And if I ask I ask yes and no questions and then get irritated when someone just doesn't give me a yes or no question. I've actually gone to the emergency room thinking I'm having congestive heart failure because my ankles swell up, and the doctor goes, oh, no, that's just seasonal. I have a friend who also has the same problems I have, but he doesn't have any mental problems.
Okay, Ted, you're going to have to focus. There's a lot of people behind you. What's the question? What is there a question?
So is it seasonal affective disorder as well in the summer as in the fall?
Okay, good question, Ted, because most people have what we call seasonal affective disorder and get depressed in the fall and then feel better in the spring. And we think about them putting their light box on and making sure that they take their antidepressant. But some people who are bipolar will have seasonal components, get depressed in the winter, and then get hypomanic or manic in the spring. And so people like you, if this is what you have, would want to have a medication adjustment in the spring and really keep close tabs with your physician. So that you prepare for the change in season. And it you know, it's not so strange if you think about hibernation. You know,
the bears.
Yeah, that we have a primitive part of us that wants to hibernate, and depression makes us move less and put on weight and not want to go outside. And we think that's what seasonal affective disorder is, kind of hibernation.
That's interesting.
Would allergies, because of all the pollen in the air, also heighten this?
I have not heard of that. You may just have seasonal affective disorder and allergies.
Ah, okay.
Ted, thanks for the great call.
Thank you.
1-800-348-2551. We'll go to now Josh in Albany. Josh.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty good.
Good. My question was about children being prescribed mood-altering drugs such as Ritalin and Adderall, and I just wanted to see what the doctor thought about that. And when it comes to ADD and creating what could be some sort of a chemical dependence at a very young age.
So we know that the numbers of young people being prescribed stimulants for ADHD has increased from about 5% to 15%, and we think that only 5% truly have ADHD. That's a problem. So we want to treat that 5%, but not over-medicate. And I think one way to do that is to see someone who's board certified in child and adolescent psychiatry, and someone who's invested in helping your child and not just writing medications.
But talking about investment, Dr. Michael.
Is it true that a lot of that stuff can actually even be controlled through diet? Because I know I heard you with an earlier call speaking about, you know, white carbohydrates and increase in blood sugar and all that stuff. I think all of that also may play a role. And I know that when kids eat sugar, they get super hyper. So, you know, not just candy, but also, hot things that increase blood sugar. And can diet play a role in helping to maintain
ADHD? Okay, Josh,
ADHD?
We're going to get an answer for you.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Diet will not cure ADHD, but certainly if a child has a very poor diet, high in sugar and caffeine, they could get very agitated, have difficulty focusing, and get a false diagnosis.
I thought Josh's point was very good about investment. I mean, I know physicians who their whole practice is doing nothing more than, you know, pushing these drugs across the table. So I think there are some physicians, right, who have to be somewhat responsible for this.
Yes, and I think a lot of them are. I work very, very closely with Brenda Butler at Berkshire Medical Center, and she's very careful. She provides comprehensive evaluations, and she's not running to write a prescription. She wants to know what's going on.
Right.
And, you know, being defocused can have many precipitants. It doesn't have to be that the child has ADHD.
Yeah, Josh, thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Let's go to Kevin in Northampton. Okay, Kevin, you're on.
How you all doing today? Anyway, I just wanted to talk about a couple different things here. One, decoupling addiction from mere physical dependence, because I know, because in another place, I identify as an addict named Kevin, and my clean date's January 1st, 1998, And I know I was an addict long before I picked up a substance because I had all the behaviors of it. And I know I remained an addict after I put the substances on because I've got all the behaviors of it. And that's what I'm working on. So, you know, decoupling physical dependence as the nature of addiction, because it is so much broader than that. You know, I know for myself, putting down the drugs was merely the very beginning of recovery. And also I wanted to talk about the crime that is the drug replacement industry. I loathe those people, and I really wish we could find some way to stop them.
Which people?
And how do you feel about that?
Which people?
You love the whole drug replacement industry.
I'll respond to that. So Kevin, first of all, congratulations on being clean and sober for 15 years. That's wonderful. And we were just talking about that the movie that's playing this Thursday at the Beacon in Pittsfield, The Anonymous People. Mm-hmm. Which celebrates people who are clean and sober. So Kevin is talking about replacement therapy, medications like methadone and buprenorphine.
Uh-huh.
And so it's a charged issue. Some people feel that these medications are saving people. Other people feel that it's the wrong thing to do. I can tell you in my experience, I have seen many people overdose and die because they didn't get treatment. And methadone has been around for about 40 years or more, and has been studied for decades, and it is clearly associated with diminished criminal activity, increased employment, and also decreased health care costs. So people become more functional, they're more likely to work. It's not a perfect medication, and some people continue to use other drugs, and that's a problem.
Let me tell you, from my own experience, people who get on drug replacement who are convinced by medical professionals that they need to be on it long term for the rest of their lives, they are not being served properly.
Okay, wait, Kevin, because she's the guest and we're going to let her finish the sentence. Go ahead.
So it depends on the person. It's unfair to make a global term about those people or these people. We're talking about saving people's lives and making them functional. Some people will need replacement therapy for shorter periods and some for longer. It's keeping people alive and as functional as possible. And that's a decision that the patient will make with his or her physician.
Kevin, got to let you go. Thank you very much. Let's go to Paul in Pittsfield. Paul, you're on.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I love it when you two hook up on Vox Pop. My work is in substance abuse prevention in Pittsfield. And, Alan, I loved your article about marijuana you posted just a couple of weeks back, maybe a month ago.
Yep. And I quoted Dr. Michaels, as a matter of fact.
You did. But you did say that I said it was a gateway drug. But that's a very antiquated term. I think we need to move. We're going to move on to something else.
Okay.
Is that fair? Is that okay, Alan?
No, anything you say, doctor.
Okay.
I'm in your debt.
Do what the doctor orders, Alan.
Okay.
Yeah, indeed.
Okay. I appreciate it.
My question is, how can we as a community re-increase the perception of harm of marijuana and youth use and decrease the attitudes being favorable toward marijuana use? I think that we're doing a really good job with adults sort of coming to terms with learning about what is marijuana and what isn't it as a medicine and even down the road as a recreational taxable substance. But I'm really, really focused and I care greatly about young people not having as much access to it as a substance and having the community be really intelligent about increasing the perception of harm and letting young people know that it is not harmless. It's just maybe less harmful than other substances.
Okay, that's great, Paul. Let's let Dr. Michaels get a shot.
Okay, so I think we're giving mixed messages to kids because we're confused. I think we haven't made up our minds. And so we know things like marijuana is less, I'll use the term, less addictive than other substances and less dangerous than other substances. And we now have medical marijuana in Massachusetts. We haven't really dealt with the downside. We haven't been clear about it with young people. And there are a lot of studies out there that show that if you start using marijuana at a very early age, you're more likely to struggle with addiction. And also for small subgroups with a certain type of genetic loading, it increases the chance that you will develop schizophrenia.
What do you mean genetic loading?
So it's a bit of a biology lesson, but we have certain genes that code for enzymes. I'll give you an example. It's a COMPT gene. It's COMPT. a COMT gene. And if you have a certain gene sequence for that, and then you smoke marijuana, your chances of getting schizophrenia skyrockets.
Interesting.
Yes. If you don't smoke marijuana and you have that gene, you don't get schizophrenia. Yeah. So that we can't say this, the marijuana causes it, but there is a very strong relationship between that gene, the starting of the initiation of marijuana use, and then developing
schizophrenia. But not with smoking, for example, just marijuana.
Just marijuana.
Interesting.
Isn't that fascinating? And it tells me that we have so much more to learn. We are just in our infancy of studying this because marijuana is illegal, and it's really challenging to get to study it.
Yeah. Hey, Paul, thank you for the wonderful call. Appreciate it very much.
Take care.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go to Lisa in Albany. Okay, Lisa, you're on.
Yes, hi. Well, first of all, before I forget, I wanted to see if the doctor could repeat the name of the gene that she just mentioned about causing schizophrenia.
C-O-M-T.
C-O-M-T?
C-O, it's C-O-M-T. It was a study looking at the nucleotide valine versus, this is deep in my brain, I can't remember. But it's a study looking at marijuana smoking in teens and risk of developing schizophrenia. If you Google those two together, you will see a whole bunch of literature come out. And if you look at genotype.
Yeah, okay, great. That's great information. My question actually had to do with attention deficit disorder, or ADHD. And the correlation with food coloring. I know the FDA had done some studies back in the 80s, and they found that certain coloring in food caused hyperactivity in children. But there hasn't been any recent study that I'm aware of.
Lisa, only because we're almost out of time, Dr. Michaels, could you just answer what you know about this? Do you have any?
I really don't know anything about food coloring at ADHD. I'm sorry. I'm going to go home and research.
Indeed. That'll be our homework. Thank you, Lisa.
And
we'll go to Philip in Northampton. Philip, you can make a sentence. Go ahead.
I just wanted to comment on the drug replacement therapy.
Philip, you busted up. Say again.
I just wanted to comment on the drug replacement therapy issue, and I was on methadone for about 4 years, and I've been on Suboxone for about three, and, I constantly have clinicians, say that it's pretty much a success story in my life, and I've been able to keep great full-time employment, and I have no fear of going back to opiates ever again, and I recognize the addictive tendency.
Okay, Philip, we're going to give Jen a chance because we're almost out of time. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, Philip, it's people like you who make me love my job because I see people like you come in often addicted to heroin, hopeless, maybe some crimes have been committed. You get sober, you get on replacement therapy, you get a job, you get healthy, you make amends, and it works. I think when we disparage replacement therapy, we're just continuing that stigma. This is a valid treatment, and he is one example of many.
So, Philip, got to be it, Philip. I thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. All right. So we're out of time. I want to thank Dr. Jennifer Michaels of the Breen Center and from the Berkshire Medical Center for being with us today. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks to Colleen O'Connell for answering the phones. Tom Job handled our social media. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Alan Shartok. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Remember, the conversation continues online at wmc.org/VoxPop. On tomorrow's forum, an open program. Stay tuned now for a news update. But before we go, Dr. Michaels, tell us about that film one more time.
Oh, one more time. Yeah. It's called The Anonymous People. It's playing this Thursday, December 19th, 6:45 to 9 o'clock, Beacon Cinema. And it's free and there's food.
And what's it about again?
It's about people who are sober and in recovery, living beautiful lives, being citizens. And it's to destigmatize the disease of addiction.
So it's got an upbeat theme to it.
Oh, happy.
As opposed to so many films we see these days where things don't come out all that well. We thank you so much, Dr. Jennifer Michaels.
Thank you.
And now, Zach Malloy, take it away.